This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Take a look around. Look at the stuff that surrounds us. What role do material goods play in our day-to-day lives? Beyond their utilitarian use, their ability to offer pleasure, what do the objects we surround ourselves with signify? Are they weighing us down? Journalist Jane Hammerslaw is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of the new book, Dematerializing, Taming the Power of Possessions. Jane Hammerslaw suggests we reevaluate and take control over what we own and what we want to own. She says, quoting here, challenging the power of possessions has to be a personal process with no right answers. Having what you want and wanting what you have isn't so much about finding an answer, but asking the questions. What power do we seek from objects and why? Most important, how can we work to retrieve that power from possessions to have what we value most? Listeners, I welcome your questions this afternoon. Join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. Give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jane Hammerslaw has worked as a columnist for the New York Post and other newspapers. Her work has appeared in many national magazines. She has also worked as a college writing instructor. Dematerializing, Taming the Power of Possessions is published by Perseus. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Jane Hammerslaw, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
At the opening of the book, you write about the power, the magic of possessions, and I think that's a really good place to start.
Okay.
Maybe you would talk with us about the pull that we experience from objects, magical pull.
It is, and it is magical. And this is the most magical time of the year in many ways. But let's talk about the magical pull of possessions. When I started looking into this issue, I really started feeling that there was a magical pull and that materialism in our culture has a long, long, long history, and it does in all cultures. The power of possessions has been told in myths, and it's something that I just kind of called materializing, where something, a feeling, something you really want, it becomes tangible. So, for example, Pinocchio becomes a real boy because he wants it so badly and because the fairy finally turns him into a real boy. And there's the whole issue of transformation when something like a feeling or anything that's intangible becomes suddenly tangible, and you can find it in that object. And I think that objects can sometimes carry a feeling or a promise of magical power when even in modern day.
Yeah. Share with us your observation about the similarities and differences between the sales pitch and the fairy tale.
I think that there's some real similarities. I think, for example, you can hear that in the fairy tale, say that the story of King Midas, where everything he touches turns to gold. Well, we hear that. We may hear that kind of pitch where if you buy something, then something will be golden in some, you know, in a metaphoric way, but it will get better. It will improve. It will magically transform it. The difference is, in the old fairy tales, there was always some hidden agenda. There was always something where there was something nasty that was going to come along with all that wonderful good stuff. It was balanced. Whereas in the sales pitches, it's always positive. It's always a win-win situation if only you purchase something.
Yeah, and in short, we forget that the Midas touch was a curse for
absolutely,
King Midas.
And there you go. The Midas touch, the curse there was that, yes, everything he touched turned to gold, including his daughter. So, in fact, in that fairy tale, it was an incredible curse. That's absolutely right. And I think that those fairy tales have lasted for as long as they have because I think that they have real truth to them, that there is a balance and that there is the upside and the downside, and they can be very extreme. Whereas what we hear so much in our culture, for better or for worse, is there's no downside. It's always great. And if you own something, it's a good thing.
Hmm. In spite of that message about the Midas touch in that fairy tale, we're so heavily invested in this stuff.
Yes, I think that we are. And I certainly felt that way, which is why I wrote the book. I was feeling just overwhelmed by it. And, you know, you don't have that many choices. It's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to just say no to so many cultural prompts that we receive. So my sense with all of this is that we really have to examine our own relationships with objects and figure out how we can deal with it in our own lives if we feel overwhelmed.
Yeah. Have we spent as much time thinking about and acquiring possessions in the past? Have you
Hello?
Got a... Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay,
but
I'm sorry.
It almost
went funny with the phone.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It sounded like we were interrupted by a train almost.
Very
there.
Strange.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, today as opposed to yesterday in terms of, you know, have we spent in the past as much time thinking about and acquiring possessions as we do today?
I think it's been an issue for a long, long time. 100 years ago, Thorsten Veblen was writing about materialism and was very concerned with what he coined. The term that he coined, which was conspicuous consumption. And so it's been an issue for quite a while, if not long before that. I think what's changed a lot is that we have more messages and more information than ever before in much greater numbers and at a much greater volume. So we hear a lot more about it. So I think that's one change that's occurred. I think another change that's occurred is... Hello? Hello?
Hi.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Now it sounds much better.
Much better, okay. Another change...
We're going to put a phone on your... on your list of possessions or not.
It was something funny. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry about it.
The other thing that's happening, actually, it fits right into what just happened here, is the urgency of technology. I think for better or for worse, again, it's simply part of living in the real world. We hear so much about what technology can do for us, and in fact, it does do for us. But if you look back even 10 years, think about the things which you didn't have, which you didn't even think about having, even 20 years, computers, cell phones, Blackberries, cordless phones, all of these things which become kind of essential. And so they take up a lot more energy and time and thought than they may have in the past because they simply didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, you know, we used to talk about planned obsolescence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But now, you know, some facets of technology are changing so quickly that term, the idea of planned obsolescence, seems so dated.
That's right. Planned obsolescence is the idea that something is going to fall apart and you're going to have to replace it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now what we've got is basically, it's changing so fast, it's not even going to wear out before you need something else. And so I think it puts enormous pressure on people that feel that they need to keep up, and whether that means having a little Palm Pilot or a Blackberry or anything else, or if it means having the latest pair of jeans if you're a kid, I think that the connection to that object may become stronger for some people or for many people. We certainly hear about it a lot more than we ever did in the past.
Yeah. It also seems to me that we turn to possessions as a form of comfort.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I know it goes back. Heinz Kohut was a psychoanalyst who wrote about something called self-objects, which could be the blanket which little children carry, Linus's blanket,
sure,
or something like that, where people do seek comfort. And I do think that there is a great comfort that we also hear about so much. You will feel better if you buy this thing. And you know what? The fact is, sometimes you really can get comfort from certain things. But the big question is, how far does it go? And does seeking that kind of comfort from objects intrude on actually finding true, real comfort, authentic comfort from other people or from yourself?
Yeah. Also, we use things as a way of rewarding ourselves.
Oh, yes. And I think we are encouraged to do that so much. I think that we hear an awful lot about how hard our lives are. And you know what? Sometimes life is tough. However, the idea that every single thing requires owning something, holding something, being able to have that little treat for yourself, It certainly pushes buying things, but I think it also maybe discourages us from looking into ways that we could reward ourselves in ways that are perhaps more longer lasting and more meaningful.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we all grow out of that
right.
stage where we need to, you know, have a quarter to, you know, bring home a good paper.
That's right. Although, you know, I think that because it's so easy, and it's so easy to believe that it's going to work, it seems like it should happen, and it is just sort of a part of maturity. But I do think that in a way we're encouraged to be very immature with all of this. I mean, if you act like a little kid, you know, you're more vulnerable, maybe.
Hmm.
You're more vulnerable to the messages that keep telling you you will feel better. There's something that unites, I think, a lot of messages that we hear. And I don't want to attack, by the way, I don't want to attack advertising or marketing or anything. This is the way people make a living. I'm not knocking it. It's really part of living in this country. So that's just a given. But we do tend to hear an awful lot about dissatisfaction. And I do think that hearing a lot about dissatisfaction and feeling why you should feel bad can make you that much more vulnerable to finding a solution in an object.
Hmm. At the same time, as you said before, though, on the issue of things is looking for toward things, looking to things to provide comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can provide comfort, and sometimes we do need that reward.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a hell of a day.
Exactly, and it can help. It really can help sometimes. So the big question I think that we need to ask ourselves is it intruding on what we're really seeking? If you've had a really lousy day, it may help to buy the new lipstick or whatever. Whatever it is that, you know, the CD, whatever. It may be helpful. It may work. Great. However, is it habitual? Does it get in the way of other things? Does it get in the way of your finding a solution? Let's say you have a lousy day and you constantly are having a lousy day because you have a lousy job. Is that going to help the situation ultimately? Or is it just going to kind of get you through the next 5 minutes and then you feel just as bad?
So how do you step back and try and get a grip on, you know, what's really at work in any given situation?
I think one thing that you can do is literally step back and say, okay, why am I doing this? I mean, I think that's very important to try to cultivate some mindfulness about what it is that you're seeking. And what that intangible thing is that you're seeking from an object. And I'm not just talking about buying objects. I'm talking about reacting to objects. For example, you know, if you see somebody wearing something that you react to, you know, a kid in a sloppy outfit or, you know, maybe perhaps an object which you and somebody else both want, say, a family situation where people are arguing over an object, an inheritance or something like that, step back and say, okay, what's worth more here, preserving a relationship, having a relationship, cultivating that relationship, or owning this object? So it's part of it's about maybe standing at that checkout counter and sort of checking in with yourself to see if you really need something, if you really want something. The other side of it is, just in general, it's not just about buying things. It's also about evaluating how much objects may intrude on what you want most.
The second chapter of your book is about the past, mm-hmm. and how it affects us,
mm-hmm.
how our experience with the past colors our present. And given that we're soon to be spending a significant amount of time, perhaps, with family and that kind of thing, and we're going to, you know, it is the season of giving,
yes.
Hanukkah, Christmas, New Year's. Would you talk with us about what we do sometimes to try to recapture the past, mm-hmm. by acquiring either something we lost or trying to remake the past,
mm-hmm.
by acquiring something we felt we were deprived of?
Mm-hmm. I think that there are so many situations where you remember something and it, for example, a Christmas tree. That Christmas tree was so big when you were 3 feet tall. A 6-foot Christmas tree was monumental. And I think when you are 6 feet tall yourself, suddenly, or 5 feet tall as a grown-up, suddenly it doesn't look so big. And I think that sometimes what we would like more than anything is to recreate that sense of wonder of looking at that big Christmas tree. And so the logical thing would seem to get the 9 foot tall Christmas tree. I'm speaking a little bit metaphorically here, but you see what I mean. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Or a Christmas tree in every room?
Absolutely, a Christmas tree in every room. Deck the halls everywhere. And you know what? People get an awful lot of pleasure out of it, so I don't want to knock that categorically. But I think it is worth examining what we're really hoping to get. And it does strike me during the holiday season especially, there is a tendency to go overboard for many, many reasons. And one of those reasons is because we don't want anybody to feel disappointed. We don't want our children to feel disappointed. We ourselves don't want to feel disappointed. People want to avoid disappointment. The other side of it is that maybe we had wonderful Christmases. We had that huge Christmas tree, or, you know, as a child, we got exactly what we wanted, and we worry so much about not being able to do that ourselves. And so there's maybe a tendency to go kind of crazy with acquiring stuff or putting the faith in those objects that that's going to deliver on those really good feelings that we had when we were children. Or didn't have. That's the other side, right?
Right. The other side is, I didn't have this as a kid, so my kids are going to have this.
That's right. And I think that's the place where you have to say, okay, who am I doing this for? Why am I doing it? And what am I really giving? And is it really giving, or is it giving to me? Is this giving to somebody else? Is this what they really want? Is this providing something that's going to last? I think that there's something with pressure that people feel sometimes around the holiday season, where if you don't get that toy that's the hot toy this year, then your kid's going to be terribly disappointed, and the whole holiday season may be a failure. And I think what we need to do a little bit is look and step back and say, okay, what can you keep? What can my child cherish? What will they hold? What's their memory going to be? And I think all of us as parents would probably say, you know, I would rather have my child not remember me stressed out about money and screaming at my spouse and arguing about where the money's going to go during the holiday season, or, you know, feeling some kind of resentment. They would much rather not have that memory. Their kids have that memory. They'd rather have the memory of the warmth and the good feeling and the sense of satisfaction and goodwill that we can engender by not necessarily going overboard with gifts.
Yeah. You've seen the movie A Christmas Story, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of interesting possessions in that movie and gifts.
Yeah.
But what it all comes down to is someone's memories, not so much of the things.
That's right.
But what they signified.
That's right. That's where the little boy desperately wants the BB gun.
Right. Ralphie.
Yes. I loved it. Gene Shepherd. Shepherd, that's right. Gene Shepherd, terrific movie.
And he wants that Red Ryder BB gun.
That's right.
And his dad just is crazy about that major award that he wins, the lamp. And but what it all comes down to is not so much the things, but
the feeling.
The feeling.
Yes.
That the family was together, and it was times where the Christmas turkey is eaten by the neighborhood dogs, and poor Ralphie has to put on the bunny suit.
Oh my! Oh, but, you know, it's a great movie. It's terrific, and I do think that it brings up an awful lot of these things. And the bottom line is, it is that feeling, and every one of those objects is just awful. You're absolutely right, and yet, and I do think that sometimes maybe in our own lives, you know, we can, there's the other side, which is that the wonderful Christmas stories where there's wonderful emotion and feeling and everybody gets exactly what they want. And somehow when you see these Christmas specials, and the one you're talking about is wonderful and hilarious, but I do think that there is a standard which we can't really live up to sometimes. And we're especially vulnerable to that during holidays where, gosh, it seems like everybody's having a perfect Christmas and a wonderful, wonderful holiday season. I mean, that one is quite honest, but I think that sometimes we get an awful lot of messages about that best Christmas ever, and if only you have that one thing, it will just be perfect.
And if I only had more time with the hot glue gun.
There you go. Well,
there's a funny story in the book that you tell on yourself.
Yes. I was standing one evening a few years ago. It was evening is a euphemism. It was actually 2 a.m, and I was standing at the kitchen table with my hot glue gun and a styrofoam ball and some lovely pine cones sitting around me. And this was the night before a holiday party that I was throwing, and I had been cooking all day, and I was really exhausted. But I had seen a picture of a centerpiece in a magazine, and I wanted that centerpiece to be at my party because that was going to make the party wonderful. And I don't quite know how I made this connection, but somehow in that magazine, everybody looked so happy, and the title of the magazine article was something like Giving Guests a Warm Welcome. Everybody looked happy. The party was wonderful. The children were in soft focus somewhere in the background. I just wanted that party to be mine so much. I just had this incredible fantasy. And the way I was going to get that party, because I was a little addled at that point, was I was going to make this fabulous centerpiece, and then everything would be perfect. So it was 2 a.m, and there I was with my hot glue gun. And there I had a vision, which was like, you know, Scrooge's vision. Which was, I saw myself in the mirror, I had completely bloodshot eyes, I had a pine cone stuck in my hair, and I thought, oh my, I've lost it. I am crazy. It's 2 a.m. What am I doing? And it was that moment that I suddenly said, this is insane, this is crazy, it's time to back off of this. And the beautiful thing that happened, I cleaned everything up. It felt very liberating. I put everything away. I swept up the pine cones and had the party the next day without a centerpiece. And it didn't look the way the magazine piece did. My kids weren't in soft focus. They were loud and they had chocolate on their faces, and so did the rest of the kids at the party. It didn't look perfect, and it wasn't what it looked like in the magazine pictures. But as a party, it was a lot better. It was great. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize you don't necessarily have to have that perfect centerpiece. It can work anyway.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jane Hammerslaw. We're talking with her about her book, Dematerializing, Taming the Power of Possessions. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
This is a very timely program for me. I buy for a very few people, but I buy for some people. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what to buy for them. They don't need anything.
That's right. Like many of us. Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to do for them in their name is to give some money to hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And send, either I will send it or hospice will send it, to acknowledge that a contribution has been made in their name,
mm-hmm,
in memory of my mother.
I think that's a beautiful idea. I think that's a lovely idea. And, you know, how nice for them also that they don't get one more thing that they may like or they may not, that they have to put somewhere, that they have to think about. That's a beautiful idea.
Well, it doesn't, you know, and it doesn't have to be hospice. It occurred to me because I've had experiences with hospice that have been, at the time they were needed, most meaningful, more than any gift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a lovely thing to do.
You think it's okay?
Oh, I think it's wonderful, and I think that it's something we should all think about doing because it means so much. It's such a lovely thing to do.
Well, if you need a hospice, boy, they're there, and,
mm-hmm,
and you know when you need them, you need them.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Well, I certainly enjoy the program. I don't call in very often, but I certainly enjoy and wish Celeste and yourself a very happy
And to you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy Thank holidays.
You. Great. What a good idea.
And, you know, sometimes you try and tell somebody that you really don't need anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that message doesn't get absorbed, and you'd really wish for somebody to do something like this in your name. What a beautiful gift.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's right. And I think maybe people have to, you know, one thing is that when you say that, when people say that, I think they do mean it, but sometimes people don't believe it. You're right, that people are serious about that. But really, you know, what do you give? And that, there's the answer. And that's a great thing to do.
Yeah. The grand gesture is still a powerful motivator, though.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is. That's right. It's that big surprise, and that maybe it comes in a little tiny box, or maybe it's some other thing. But that grand—that's right. The grand gesture. You need an audience. I think that the audience is often a big part of it, and somehow that grand gesture is going to say everything that you want it to say, and people are going to understand it exactly as you intend it to be heard, and that. That's right. It's difficult to move away from the grand gesture. I think that something that is so powerful in our culture, and maybe in other cultures as well, are engagement rings, which tend to be great big grand gestures on many, many levels for people. And it's worth sort of revisiting what they carry, what kind of weight they carry, and what we may seek in those things. I'm talking to women primarily, but also to men, I guess, too. But there are a lot of grand gestures that we may go through and feel pressure to either give or get ourselves. That somehow, you know, something signifies the extent that somebody cares or the extent that they love you or whatever. And I think that it's important to really examine what the kind of power we're turning over to a little tiny ring or anything else.
Yeah. There's a little anecdote in the book about, I believe, a man and his father, and this grown-up son says, "I feel like my father is trying to buy me off."
Mm-hmm.
That is so sad, and perhaps that's not what Dad intends at all.
No.
He just wants to share. He's thinking he wants to be generous with his children.
That's right, and I think that the the issue maybe is, are you trying? Is how much can objects really say? And are they, if you allow them to speak for you, are they being heard in the way that you're intending them to be heard? Or is somebody hearing something totally different? You know, one man's weed is another man's wildflower. And I think that the really important thing is to maybe not turn over the power of communicating quite so much, so that is it, you know, for the father and the son to just sit down and maybe have a conversation could be so much more useful for everybody than second-guessing around an object.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener.
Great.
In Pisotum on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I agree that one man's weed is another man's wildflower. And I think some of the best gifts you can give are of your own time.
Absolutely.
Let me go and... here's a gift certificate for cleaning your house or something along those lines. I have to say that if somebody said, "I've given a donation to thus and such a charity in your name," I would not be pleased at all because for a couple of reasons. One, because it's more that would be more about the giver out of that own person's sense of what is going on.
Mm.
It would pay no attention to me, and it would also put me on a mailing list for a very long time.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, and
so you're talking about giving, say, time and energy and attention, personal,
or food,
something that you've created, or.
I try to take as much time as I can, when I'm giving gifts, and I generally give gifts to family, to really understand who they are and what they like. I tend to give books because I don't tend to think of those as objects, but as something that keeps on giving, if you
Right.
will.
Right. Right. So what you're talking about is really the thought going into something personally and not necessarily giving something. Do you feel that it's sort of anonymous to give a donation to a charity? And what you're talking about is kind of a personal connection to the people that you're giving to.
Precisely. I mean, that's what giving a gift is about. It's about, to me at least, it's saying, I do value you, and so I am taking the time either to find something that you will like or to give you of myself. And if I'm just sending off a check to a charity and saying, here, send the card to this person, then I'm showing that it's sort of like electronic greeting cards. When you don't have the time to send anything, send this.
That's interesting. Well, yeah. I think that what you're talking about really is acknowledging that person and what they would like.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And also, I think what the caller, and correct me if I'm wrong, is saying is that also what we give is very much a part of who we are.
Yes, absolutely. And for example, if a person's favorite charity were something, I might give a donation to a charity in someone's name, but I would ask them what their favorite charity was.
Right,
and if it was something I disagreed with, I couldn't. But then I would find some other gift to give. Yeah, it would be like giving a donation to the Democratic Party to a Republican.
Now there's a gift.
It would be something I would give to someone I didn't like.
Whoops.
Well, actually, that's...
Or maybe not whoops, but ha-ha.
There is something I do think, actually, you're bringing up a point which I find quite interesting, which is there are hostile gifts. I mean, you know, I do think that sometimes it's like giving the... I had heard a story about a woman, whose mother used to give her sweaters that were two sizes smaller than the size she actually wore because the mother didn't really think she was thin enough. She wanted her to lose weight, and so she would give her these teeny sweaters. And the interesting thing is, I heard a similar story from somebody else whose boyfriend gave her two small sweaters, and she loved it because she felt she was too fat. He saw her as this tiny, you know, petite little cute thing.
Right.
And so it's sort of what we bring to that object. I mean, it's interesting. You know, it can either be hostility or you can view it as kind of a compliment almost. It's funny. But
it's who gives it and in what spirit they give
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, if it comes with strings, it's not a gift. Free gift is a redundancy.
That's absolutely right. It's got to be given. It's got to be given with purely. And openly. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for an interesting program.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
This afternoon. Other calls are welcome, questions, comments. Give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Jane Hammerslaw, author of the book Dematerializing, Taming the Power of Possessions. A very timely program, timely topic for this time of year. We've got another call coming in on line one. Where are you calling from this afternoon, Champaign?
Hi,
Celeste. Hi. Hello.
It's Carol Morgan. I'm calling in from Champaign.
Uh-huh.
And I just had a comment. I'm so glad you're doing shows like this because we have all kinds of friends who already have everything they need.
Mm.
We're trying to dematerialize and cut back. And I just finished a master's degree in environmental education. So all of a sudden I'm having this epiphany about material things and environmental low impact and such as that. And what we're doing for Christmas this year, and we'll probably continue to do for things like birthdays and wedding gifts and things like that, is to help people with fine-tuning at home. You know, they already have everything, but giving gifts that are environmentally considerate but that people wouldn't necessarily go and buy for themselves, like compact fluorescent bulbs, faucet aerators that save water, low-flow shower heads that save water. And I just purchased some really nice heavy-duty cloth, they're canvas bags that people can take to the grocery store. So they don't have to take paper or plastic. they can use cloths that they can just use and use and use and use.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think fine-tuning and helping people replace things that they may already have, but helping them become environmentally aware without having to change their actual behaviors,
mm-hmm.
This is a good opportunity. And so far I've asked several people that we would normally give gifts to, which of these items would they like for mm. Christmas? I've already purchased them, and they get to choose. And they actually get excited about this fact. And, you know, I am offering installation also. So, you know, if they
want
a faucet area, I'll
this
put
is
it
full
in
service.
Because, you know, they may not necessarily know quite how to do it.
How are people reacting?
Very positively.
Are they?
In fact, one friend said, gee, I actually want two of those things.
Oh, boy.
Do I have to choose?
That's
pretty
neat.
Well, you know, maybe I can save one for you for Valentine's Day, or, you know, we can just, sure, why not, take two.
So you're basically, it sounds like you're taking what you feel is important, and you're trying to share that with the people that you give gifts to.
Mm-hmm. Without, you know, expecting them to do anything, you know, I'm finding with my...
Right, rather than demanding that they do, which,
right.
Again, it's sort of a toxic gift, but it sounds like what your approach is makes a difference and may improve their lives, and you're giving it in a good spirit.
Sure.
And you're offering them a choice, which is really nice.
Yeah. I would love to.
Great.
You know, I would love it if somebody did something like that to me.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
Yeah.
Particularly because it's nice because it's not something that, as the recipient... You have to, I mean, I hate to say it, but you don't have to think a whole lot about it. You don't have to find a place.
Right.
The faucet head, you know, you need a faucet head, and it's going to be on the faucet,
mm-hmm.
I mean, regardless. So you don't have to say, oh, this is going to collect dust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just, it's useful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Great.
Well, there's my contribution. Thanks so
Great.
Much.
Thank
I look
you.
Forward to seeing your book.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For the call mm-hmm. this afternoon. I like the multiple choice idea.
That's
kind of fun.
I love it. It's great.
You know, every family is different, and individuals, are, of course, are very individual. Duh. But some folks I was getting to know, some years ago, we just played this goofy little game about, you know, likes and dislikes and,
mm-hmm.
and favorite colors, favorite foods, and that kind of thing. And it was fun. I think some people might roll their eyeballs at that. But it was fun, and it gave us some insights into one another, and whether it was like whether we're going to have one another over for a meal or buy a gift or do something for somebody. It offered a lot of clues.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. Well, and you were actually talking. You weren't just looking around each other's houses and saying, let's see. They've got this kind of brand of refrigerator, so they must be this sort of person. I mean, you were actually speaking with each other about this stuff.
Yeah.
Which really makes a big difference.
Yeah, because when you first are getting to know people, it can be awkward, and you can find yourself in a situation where, you want to do something or you need to do something
mm-hmm.
To show your appreciation for an earlier act of kindness
mm-hmm.
or something, and that way you're, you know, hopefully you're hitting the target.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
You're,
and you're not giving something that's just completely inappropriate or you know, unwanted.
Oh yeah, or they already have or
yes,
not interested
exactly.
in it at all.
That's right.
One of the things you talk about in the book you write about is something I think that's interesting. And when we go to the mall or when we're purchasing things. Something to think about in order to do this thing where you step back and get a grip on what's at work
mm-hmm.
in the situation is you say it's important to differentiate buying from being.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about that?
Sure. I think that we hear an awful lot that somehow we will become real. And I mean that, you know, the way Pinocchio becomes a real boy. The wooden puppet becomes a real boy. We will become real. We will become more of who we are, who we should be, if we own something and if we are in possession of something. To my mind, that's sort of like being possessed by something. You are not what you own. However, we all know that rationally. But I think we hear so much that if you buy something, you will be something. I think it can inform many, many things, including morality. I think that we hear an awful lot about you will be a good person if you get this healthy snack or whatever, or you will show how your children how much you love them if you, you know, nothing says loving like that bake, you know, whatever from the oven. I mean, there are a million examples. When you start thinking about it, you will be that good mother or that good person or that good boyfriend or, you know, the good son, whatever, good daughter. Good, good, good. Well, obviously, all of us, we're not stupid. We know, really, that morality is not dictated. Being truly good, doing the right thing, it doesn't happen because you've happened to buy the right brand of anything. It happens because of what you do. And it is easy. It seems like sort of like a shortcut to virtue to just buy something and then you'll become something else. And I do think it's really important to remind ourselves that process doesn't work. And what is it that you can do now to do the right thing rather than simply saying, well, I'm doing the right thing by buying this and, you know, it will transform me, because transformation and growth take time, they take energy, they take attention, and sometimes they're difficult. Mm. The purchasable solution is very easy, and generally it doesn't have the same long-lasting impact or satisfaction of actually doing something to become rather than just buy.
Mm. This is, you know, hard stuff for a lot of us to do as adults.
Oh,
now, what about children? You know, there's all the same kinds of pressures come to bear, only kids...
they're more vulnerable.
More vulnerable.
They are more vulnerable. You know, kids have become an incredibly powerful buying group in our country, and one of the largest, fastest-growing, I should say, new consumer groups is the under-2s, believe it or not. I mean, as a consumer group, they've emerged, and that's a little scary. So, kids hear an awful lot of messages. Kids also influence more buying decisions than ever. I think it's something like $30 billion a year that kids influence. So clearly kids' influence is strong. The pressures on children, because of that, are equally strong, if not way stronger than they have ever been in the past. So as parents, how do we kind of work with kids to value what we feel is important and what they rather than just, you know, what they can get next at the mall? And I think something that we can do, one small thing that we can do kind of regularly and easily, this is easy, is to work with our kids to acknowledge the things that are important that we don't buy. And that sounds very simplistic. However, I think it takes a conscious act to look around and say, my, what a beautiful day. Aren't we lucky? And to acknowledge how lucky you are and they are. Not, boy, kid, you should appreciate this, but just observing and noticing ways to be grateful. I think it's terribly important for kids to learn how to be grateful and have that example set for them. So those things that aren't purchasable, that aren't ownable, but simply are.
Yeah. As you wrote this book and thought about these issues, did you find yourself looking around the house and talking with your husband and your two sons about maybe we could, you know, maybe we could give away some of these things that we don't use, or maybe we could hold off on X, Y, or Z?
You know, we did talk about that. I still live in a cluttered house, I'll be really honest with you. I live in kind of a messy house, and we have too much stuff, and I still have too much stuff. And for me, certainly getting rid of things is something that is an ongoing process, and I would like to continue with that more so. I think that the thing that really emerged as I was writing the book was considering what I was seeking in objects and talking with my kids about why they really wanted something and not just what they wanted, but, you know, you have all those baseball cards. You really, really want more. Why do you want more? And if you really, really want more, and you can really think about it and say reasonably, yeah, I really want more, and here's why, that's one thing. If you just keep buying them sort of compulsively because they're there, I think it's an opportunity to sort of step back and say, okay, maybe I need to change this a little bit. You know, it's funny, my children really got into this. And once they started really thinking about it, and they're pretty young, but they got it. And, you know, you can start talking back to certain marketing messages and kind of work with your kids on that, not necessarily to put anything down, but to just try to cultivate a little bit of mindfulness. And I think, yeah, definitely that happened as I was working on this book.
Good place to wrap up. We're out of time. We have to go. Thank you so much, Jane, for talking with us. Happy holidays.
You too, and to everybody listening.
Okay.
Great.
Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Jane Hammerslaw has been our guest this afternoon. She's the author of Dematerializing, Taming the Power of Possessions.